The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, yesterday in the Financial Times, respected publication, the central bankers in Europe were polled, and they see pretty much as a whole that over the next 25 years, the dollar will be replaced as the reserve currency. The article goes on to say that they actually see, if there's any changes, they see more accumulation of gold and less accumulation of dollars.
Kevin, I was in Boston this last week, the tail end and over the weekend, and made my way into a used bookstore and found a gem. It's a dialogue amongst academics, economic and financial academics.
Well, it sounds like it's right up your alley. A dialogue, not everybody thinks that sounds like a real treasure.
I know. Yeah. Well, you know, more than just the cover was golden. That was golden. But the content and the conversation was about what was happening in the world monetary system in 1966. That's when the book was published, and you had Triffin, you had Mundell, you had Jacques Roof, you had some of the leading economists and bankers of the day discussing what role gold needed to play or should play with the current crisis. And the current crisis centered on the two other reserve assets that central bankers were collecting.
Gold was one of them.
But the other two, pound sterling and U.S. dollars.
Right.
People looked at the sterling and they looked at the dollar, and they're looking at account deficits, they're looking at budgets that are crazy, they're looking at devaluation on the paper side and wondering what needs to happen to gold in the mix, because you still have this dollar, what they called the gold exchange standard, Kevin, where you've got these three reserve assets held by central banks, and you've got two weak sisters and one bastion of strength. They're trying to make sense of how to make this stuff work.
Well, Dave, okay, there were two weak sisters, but one sister was stronger than the other because the dollar at that time still was gold-backed. I mean, the Bretton Woods system set that up to where the dollar would be redeemable in gold, and it still was in 1967, but it looked like it was waning.
And that's what we've called the fool's gold standard.
Yeah, right.
It was apparently a gold standard.
So this was a very appropriate time for these guys to be talking. If I remember right, that's the time that Jacques Roof was basically telling de Gaulle in France, go ahead and cash your dollars in for gold, because they ain't going to be trading it for long.
Right. Today we want to look at the monetary system as it exists today and look at some of the pressures that are in Europe at present. You know, we've got Robert Zoellick, as you mentioned in this Financial Times article, who's suggesting that even now gold take on a more prominent position in the world monetary system. He mentioned this maybe two or three months ago
right.
in a Financial Times op-ed piece, and was raked over the coals for the next 2 weeks by academics all across the world, accusing him of being irresponsible in his position of leadership. How could someone of his position still hold to these sort of arcane and archaic views? And furthermore, who was going to be responsible for punishing him for saying something so foolish, so stupid, so irrelevant? Because again, in the post-1971 period, we're on a completely free-floating currency system. We just want to get a grasp of how we got here and make some sense of what's happening today in Europe with the Chinese visit, Wen Jiabao going around making sort of a charity tour in Europe, if you will.
Well, he says he's going to bail Greece out, or at least help with that.
And they certainly did bail out or help with the Portuguese just a few months ago, or a few weeks ago, rather. So let's look at that, Kevin. But starting with, you know, the U.S. system and giving some history to it.
Well, Dave, let's just go back to that, because really, even before the U.S. system, there have been two competing views for most of history as to whether you give the power of the money into the hand of the people or you leave it in the government's hand and let them create money. I mean, there are two competing schools of thought that actually predate even the American Revolution, aren't there?
Well, there is. And I mean, if you wanted to go back into political dialogues and the history of thought, this goes back to ancient Greece and Rome.
Right.
You know, the idea is that there's centralized power and control on the one hand, decentralized power in the hands of the people on the other. These two toggle back and forth. The advantages to one outweigh the advantages of the other, and then the other school of thought will carry the day in argument, and you'll see a move towards decentralization, and then back to centralization. This is sort of a dialogue through several thousand years. In the U.S., it was epitomized by two people, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. Alexander
right.
Hamilton was the first Secretary of the Treasury. the very first person whose shoes are today filled by Timothy Geithner.
What's interesting, though, David, they had just fought the American Revolution, but Hamilton actually represented more of a London kind of banker than he really did an American, didn't he?
He did. He had a fascination with the old school. He had a fascination with... I mean, he really was sort of a highbrow guy, and the idea that all culture was emanating from Europe, and particularly from Britain, he definitely wanted to be considered one of the sophisticates of the day, and that included having a strong central government, and as well as a strong central bank and a strong tax regime.
Which guys like Thomas Jefferson and Adams, these guys actually were saying, wait a second, this is exactly what we fought against. This is what we just cut our ties with.
Right, and Thomas Jefferson had nothing to do with the Treasury at that point. You know, while Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury, Thomas Jefferson was the very first Secretary of State.
Like Hillary Clinton is now. Right?
Very different than Hillary Clinton.
Oh, if we could have Thomas back. Yeah.
Oh, if only. You know, not only a greater appreciation for wine in this country, maybe even better architecture, but even the architectures of our laws, et cetera, et cetera. So,
right.
Yeah, the first Secretary of the State, and then, of course, he went on to be the third President of the United States. And he was regarded, again, going back to that centralized versus decentralized theme, he was regarded as the people's president.
And he did not trust central banks.
No. He had an inherent distrust of the political and financial elites. He was quoted famously as saying, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies."
That's what is playing itself out right now in the value of the dollar.
Well, leading into the American Revolution, there was the issue of taxes, of course, and I just got back from Boston, as I mentioned, and we went on a tall ship, took the boys out, and we reenacted throwing tea into the bay. It was fantastic. You know, the boys,
you're training them upright.
But the only disappointment is the boys were expecting to be able to dress up like Mohawk Indians, and they didn't get to. So they were, you know, wondering where are their hatchets, machete, you know, where's our headdresses? But we did still get to throw the tea, and that was quite a hoot. But this was the issue. You had taxation and increased payments to the British Treasury, and there was no political voice.
Does that sound familiar today?
And it's not that they didn't have a political voice. It's not that they didn't have a representative in Parliament, but it was appointed to them. They didn't get to vote the guy in. So, you know, I mean, yes, they had representation in Parliament, but it wasn't their representation. It was sort of a stooge chosen for them,
right?
If that makes sense. And you can understand how frustrating that would be, paying into the Treasury and really not having a voice. Hamilton's actions as the first Treasury Secretary, as you mentioned, Kevin, reflected the old power structure, and really felt like the old British tax franchise was being reborn.
He could not imagine a new system, you know, and again, I keep bringing it to today. We've got a system right now that's failing miserably, and we've had guests on recently that said, go ahead and kiss it goodbye because it ain't going to look the same in the future.
Well, Hamilton's views, they were based on the legacies of the Swedish and British systems.
Right.
You know, they had worked. The Swedish system, the oldest central bank around, followed by the British system. You know, you're talking about two systems that arguably were working. So why do something different than what was working?
Albeit they were working at a deficit. I mean, these were banking systems even back then that were basically utilizing a government deficit system to stay alive.
Well, I think you can also point, at least in the British case, to gold being a part of the confidence built into the banking system.
That's true. People really understood physical ownership of gold as a type of money back then more than they do today. Well, David, history shows that Hamilton won, at least in the beginning, in having a central bank. I mean, there was a first central bank that was created right after the Constitution.
Yeah, it wasn't called the Fed at that point. It was called the First Bank of the United States. And he modeled it after the British Central Bank, 1694. And this was interesting because the first central bank was part-owned by foreigners.
Right.
And it was seen by Jefferson as an engine of financial manipulation, as a source of speculation, and as something that fostered corruption. So,
sure.
I mean, he was looking at it from a very skeptical viewpoint. It went for 20 years, and after 20 years, the charter was allowed to expire. So by 1811, that popular opinion, you know, epitomized by Jefferson's suspicion, was there, and it was seen as a bank that was self-serving and corrupt.
Well, sure. It showed its true colors right away. In fact, I've heard many people say that the War of 1812 was very much fostered by the English because of this central bank, the loss of this central bank.
Well, the second bank of the United States, the second run at this, you know, so again, the charter ended in 1911, and the copy of the first was founded in 1816. Andrew Jackson became president in 1828. and he fought the bank. Again, he fought it because he saw it as a source of political corruption and of market manipulation. And if you fast forward to today, and we'll talk a little bit about today's Fed, that is the criticism that you can level against the Fed. And this is not sort of an outlandish, from left field, fringe comment on the Fed, but who is supporting the financial markets? I mean, we've talked about them having a dual mandate. We'll spend a little bit of time today looking at their third mandate as well, which is direct intervention in the financial markets.
Right, which we've seen for the last 3 years very radically.
Right. Well, the charter, again, was allowed to expire in 1836. The public did not support that bank at all. And again, it was viewed as both self-serving and actually the dialogue of the day centered on it being constitutionally illegal, which was interesting because they were looking at it as an issue of Congress being responsible for the issue of our currency and not a private organization.
And Andrew Jackson was hailed a hero because he got rid of that bank. Most people saw the corruption the second time and they said never, ever again.
Well, and some time passed before the third version of the central bank came into being, and it was sold as a means of preventing crisis. It was sold as the antidote and the answer to what had occurred in 1807 as something that, you know, we didn't have to go through this, guys. We told you before, if you just gave us the keys to the kingdom, we would have managed this differently, and we could have all avoided all of the pain and catastrophe, the losses, the distress that the markets have been through these recent years, again, centering on 1907.
1906 through about 1912, 1913, Dave, represented a period of time that feels very much like the crisis time that we have now. You had institutions failing. You had banks coming in and bailing out other banks. You know, J.P. Morgan comes to mind. Can you outline a little bit of that period of time so that we can recognize it? It's 100 years ago. But it's almost an exact replay 100 years ago.
Sure. Now, I don't think Dodd-Frank has the same sort of significance as the Federal Reserve Act does today, except that it does go to fostering corruption in the system and establishing the frailties that we have today, creating legacies of frailties into the future.
And it's passed based on the fear that we have of losing our security.
Right. But I think if you look at the Federal Reserve Act passed December 22nd, 1913, what came before it is very telling.
Right.
You know, there was the passage of the Hepburn Act in 1906, which caused a panic in rails because it essentially controlled the freight rates and made that a centrally determined thing, not a market-determined thing. So you had a panic in the rails, which, you know, if you look at the significance of the railroad industry then, they were more significant than the industrials were at that time.
Well,
so
and then you had the disaster of the San Francisco fire that came right on the heels of that. So, you know, you've got one thing, you've got a panic, then you've got a major tragedy.
Right. It cost $350 million. Doesn't seem like much money today.
Right.
Yeah. You've got people, you've got bankers making that much, you know, in their short tenure as a CEO today, but it costs $350 million to rebuild San Francisco. It was a 4-square-mile disaster. And at the same time, you had a shrinkage of international trade in 1907 as London was tightening credit. As a consequence of the Hepburn Act, again, and the panic and the rails, Kevin, then you had the Morse-Hines duo and the failed short squeeze of United Copper. You know, essentially what they were doing is the large shareholders of the company, they saw this growing short position in the company, and they tried to prop up the shares. They went from $60 a share down to $10 a share, drove them to insolvency, which had sort of a domino effect because they didn't just own United Copper, but they also owned a number of banks in the state of Montana, which failed subsequently. And then the whole issue of, oh, well, isn't there a connection between Morse and Hines and the Knickerbocker Trust? Of course, there was no connection at all. That didn't matter. The market panic ensued, and it was sort of rumor leading to, goodness, yeah, sell today and ask questions tomorrow.
So it's like Bear Stearns to Lehman to AIG to Citigroup. It's like what we saw back in 2008.
Right. So, you know, you ended up with the panic of 1907. Subsequent to that was the creation of the National Monetary Commission in 1908.
Okay.
What went wrong? Congress has got to explore this. We've got to figure out how, we came off the rails, so to say. Well, you know, they could have looked and perhaps with some degree of reflection said, we caused it. You know, go back to the Hepburn Act. What came off the rails is the fact that we inserted the state into the equation. We should have let the market set the rates. So the National Monetary Commission was their attempt to say, you know, obviously we weren't responsible for this, but we need to find out who was responsible for this.
Okay, but speaking of rails, there was a midnight sort of secret cloak and dagger kind of meeting that actually used the rails These guys went on rail, top bankers, quietly with name changes. They didn't even use each other's names in the middle of the night down to Georgia, a place called Jekyll Island.
It was sort of a hunting enclave, a country club for the wealthiest of the wealthy at the time. And today it's a national park. You can go there and you see these massive mansions and, you know, what you might call a hunting shack. A little different than the hunting shack that might come to mind. But yeah, the billionaires of the day.
They were not there to hunt that time, though.
No, they were drafting what became known as the Federal Reserve Act. And that was circa 1910. They tried to pass it a number of times under a different name, and they couldn't get it to gain any traction. So it took them actually 3 years, up until December 22nd, 1913, before the Federal Reserve Act was passed.
And a lot of Congress was away for Christmas vacation, and they just basically stood on the floor and got it passed, something that people back in the 1840s, Americans in the 1840s, swore would never occur again.
Let's start with the third mandate of the Fed, Kevin, today, because nothing has really changed. There's been things that have been added in terms of the list of responsibilities to the Fed, and the Fed is certainly being asked to take on more of a quote-unquote regulatory position, which is very, very curious. But the unofficial third mandate, and we'll work back to the second and first, but the unofficial third mandate is that the Fed is now responsible for creating and providing liquidity to the market and maintaining asset inflation. What is the effect of that? The effect of creating asset inflation within financial assets, whether that is housing or stocks, what have you, is that there is a hope that the wealth effect will keep the consumer in the marketplace consuming. And that wealth effect is, of course, when you have your balance sheet, your personal balance sheet, which continues to grow and show, you know, bigger and bigger numbers through time, you say, well, I can afford the vacation. I can afford the extra house on the beach. I can afford a third car. I can afford the boat. Granted, I'm only going to use it 3 times a year, and it's going to cost me an arm and a leg to maintain, but that doesn't matter.
I bought my house for $100,000. Now it's worth $1 million. Why wouldn't I have a boat? In fact, why wouldn't I have a second mortgage with interest rates as low as they are? Why wouldn't I just continue to enjoy the ride?
And the Fed is trying to prop this up, asset inflation. It's not working in the housing market.
Well,
we've got
definitely
an overhang. We had the Case-Shiller this week. Year on year, the numbers were pretty bad, again, down 4% from last year. Month on month, there seems to be an improvement. Actually, it was not an improvement. It was still a decline, but not as much of a decline as expected, and that is considered an improvement.
So, David, do you see this asset inflation that they're trying to promote right now showing up in the stock market? Is this why the stock market's in the 12,000s right now, playing around with 13 sometimes? Is it because they're printing so much money?
They have tried their best to hold the market together and to prop up sentiment. Whether that can continue, we'll see. And it's timely, this week being the end of QE2. And what comes next?
Right.
What comes next? Because the concerns about inflation are global concerns. Kevin, the value added from quantitative easing 2, initiated last November and announced the last conference in Jackson Hole, is somewhat suspect. The bond market certainly didn't like it. And we saw rates rise in the subsequent months to that announcement. What will happen? Will we have quantitative easing 3? Will we not? You know, these things are important, but I want to put it in the context of what the heck is the Fed doing in the market manipulating prices to begin with? They already have 2 utterly confused mandates, and they've adopted this unofficial third. Now let's talk about the other 2.
Well, let's go backwards with the other 2, because really, David, we'll go to price stability as the last one. That's how they were sold originally from the get-go. But full employment was added as a mandate over the last 20 or 30 years, and it's compromised in that it forces the Fed to print more money than they probably ought to. If they pull QE2 and we still have unemployment running close to 10%, I mean, that's insanity. Where are the jobs going to come from now that the money's being pulled?
Well, and this is a part of the reason why Bernanke has said we'll continue providing support to the market, as in we'll keep our zero interest rate policy.
Okay.
You know, they're providing accommodation to the market because clearly they have not delivered on their second mandate, which is full employment. So the compromise really is this, Kevin. What it means is that they are more in the political fray than they should be. They're subject to political pressures, and certainly coming into a 2012 election period, you're going to see people howling over the fact that unemployment hasn't increased. Just this last week, Kevin, absurd. What is the Obama administration doing drawing down on our strategic oil reserve at a time when oil is already in decline? the next thing that you could assume is that he may, in fact, be handing out Chevy Volts if you'll vote for him. You know, there was one commentator that suggested that this last week. How much closer can you get to just outright buying votes coming into the 2012 election? You, the consumer, need a little extra help. We're going to manipulate prices lower. This is the president of the United States manipulating
the oil price.
And we've got the CFTC chasing after some guy in Sweden who owns a shipping company for making an extra $50 million, quote-unquote, manipulating the market. How about going after the president?
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com. And if you'd like to see a couple of the latest chapters from the latest DVD that will be out in the next month, go to the link on this McIlvaney Weekly Commentary page and click on it. You'll be able to watch in YouTube format. All right, now, David, you said you were going to go into monetary history of the United States. You're getting political here, you're mad. I understand that you're mad, but let's go to the first mandate.
Well, the first mandate is price stability, and the goal was to manage price inflation at an acceptable level, quote-unquote acceptable level. And what that has become is inflation targeting, wherein some range between 1% and 3% is an acceptable inflation target.
Okay, now, David. Since the early 1970s, the dollar's lost, what, 85, 90% of its buying power?
That's an acceptable devaluation of the dollar.
Okay, so that is price stability.
Well, I mean, if you assume a 2% or 3% rate of inflation, if that is a quote-unquote acceptable level,
right,
then yes, you're ultimately, over a longer period of time, going to destroy your currency.
Okay, so there's an acceptable level of bleeding, let's say. And rather than put a Band-Aid on, if you can just acceptably bleed a little bit each day, that's okay?
As long as you've got healthy bone marrow and you're cranking out the white blood cells and the red blood cells, and there's a faster replication to what you're looking at. Inflation and assuming that 2 or 3% is acceptable is like accepting the old medicine, Kevin, wherein leeching is the best way to treat any ailment. Just a little less blood in the system and you'll feel much, much better.
Okay, David, let's go back to a time when people were actually not being bled dry, okay, and when inflation wasn't necessarily an acceptable standard. You know, there was that period that the United States and Europe was on a gold standard. In fact, it could be argued that we really were on a one-world kind of currency, and it actually worked.
Well, just before we move on to that, and we've probably mentioned this ad nauseum, but the acceptable level of 2 to 3%, if that's the target, they've lied about the statistic. They've overstated GDP. They've understated real-world inflation. MIT's Billion Prices Project puts it closer to 6%. If you use the old Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers, you're between 6 and 11%.
Well, go back. Explain MIT's number, because that's something any of our listeners can go look at anytime.
Yeah, Google it, MIT Billion Prices Project, and what you'll find is that they sample, not a billion prices, but awfully close to it, in terms of prices of real goods and services and what the price trends are. Coca-Cola this week announced a 3 to 5% increase in prices. And the question is, for our Coca-Cola executives who may be listening, is this a transitory increase? Is this a temporary increase in prices, as Ben Bernanke has promised all inflation to be? I think not. This is the problem, Kevin. We have systemic inflation, we have structural inflation, and we have lying that is occurring on a regular basis about what that inflation is. It's not 3%, it's not 2%, it's not what is targeted. We have closer to 6 to 10%.
David, my wife and I go to the farmer's market here in Durango on Saturday mornings. In fact, your wife does too. And they have a lemonade stand, a fresh squeezed lemonade stand. We have our pattern, you know, we go through the farmer's market and we get to the lemonade stand.
Tom does a great job. If you happen to be passing through Durango, Tom makes a great glass of lemonade.
You are such a name dropper. But nonetheless, I was talking to Tom, and Tom said, you know, I just made a comment about Ben Bernanke, and he goes, yeah, you need to talk to Ben Bernanke. He says, my cup prices have gone up 10%, and there is a play on words here. The lemonade stand really is getting squeezed. He told me he hasn't raised his prices in 4 years, but he's getting to the point where he says he cannot continue to operate at the prices that he's already charging $3 for lemonade. And it just goes to show you that inflation's affecting the farmer's market, it's infecting the oil markets, it's infecting the labor markets, but it's definitely not affecting the government. The government has a tendency, you know, we talked about Washington, D.C. We went to D.C. last year, Dave, and we really didn't sense that they had felt any kind of pain.
Kevin, this does come back to a more philosophical argument, and in recent weeks we've talked about discussions that need to take place, not second-order discussions, but conversations relating to first-order issues. philosophical underpinnings to a broader conversation. If you aren't clear on what the basis is for certain political views, on the for certain economic views, you need to get back to the bedrock. You need to get back to the foundations and be asking those assumption-oriented questions. Kevin, for us, looking back in time, you do see this conflict between centralized government and decentralized government, and different people, maybe even different personalities, that feel more comfortable with other people making decisions versus the market and individuals making those decisions, right, as an alternative. And Kevin, if you went back to what you were suggesting earlier, our U.S. gold standard era, 1879 is when it began for us, and it moved from there to 1914. This was a unique period in time wherein you didn't have a centralized brain trust making monetary decisions.
Right.
It was on autopilot, and it functioned very well. It functioned very well. This was a global trend, Kevin, really starting from the 1860s and moving forward, wherein currencies were backed with gold. And what they were modeling this after was the British success beginning in 1717.
Which was a gold-backed, very firmly supported system.
And Kevin, with your great love of science, who put the British on the gold standard in 1717?
Well, let's see. It was a guy who just in three laws figured out how we could later go to the moon. Okay, it was Sir Isaac Newton.
And he was brought in to manage the money because the money had been mismanaged by a centralized brain trust. It was actually a money guild, literally a money guild, who had been in charge of the money supply for hundreds of years. And then the British Crown figured out that they were getting, sorry for lack of a better term, screwed by the money guild.
Well, and you know, Isaac Newton was a believer, literally, in equal weights and measures. And he came down and actually laid that out. And it's amazing what happened to modern economics, starting with Isaac Newton.
Kevin, it's interesting what happens when you put a tremendous amount of trust in man. What you end up with is a totally different set of solutions compared to there being an appeal to, let's say, something like natural law.
Right.
And Kevin, what you had with the gold standard was all foreign trade imbalances being settled automatically by gold flowing from the debtor to the creditor nation. It happened on an automatic basis. It didn't need someone pulling levers, pulling switches, clicking with the mouse to create X number of trillions of dollars in liquidity.
Dave, you didn't need credit default swaps. You didn't need all these fancy financial products guaranteeing that something would be paid because that something actually existed.
There was a natural balance, and if things got out of balance, there was a shift between inflation to deflation within the international context. Kevin, the first great period of globalization, at least in the modern era, was this gold standard period. You could look at changes in technology, freight, you could look at the steam engine. There was a number of technological innovations that made it happen, but as an underpinning, there was a trust in the settlement of trade, in the unit of account, and that trust did not, again, center on a brain trust like the Federal Reserve, like the British Central Bank, like the Swedish Central Bank. It was something that settled on an automatic basis.
But David, that trust, that gold trust, was broken with the crisis of 1914, World War I. At that point, the justification for governments to go into debt, which had been used many, many times before throughout the centuries, was to go slowly and then quickly away from the gold standard. Is that not correct?
Yeah, and it happened during the Napoleonic Wars. It was very common for countries that had adopted the gold standard to, under duress, have to finance more than they could with the current stock of money.
Right.
And so they would suspend convertibility. They would suspend the gold standard for a period of time. And the people in the marketplace, with great angst and ire, would say, we expect it. You must come back to a discipline because we don't think that money in your hands is going to be spent well. We have to have something that is supra or trans monetary. And that means simply not in the hands of a central bank.
So basically what you're saying, David, is to pay for war, sometimes you have to print more money than you actually have with the hope that afterwards you're going to be able to go back and pay that off.
Right. It was from that point forward that you began to see ivory tower solutions come into a very common sense approach to money. And the ivory tower solutions introduced in 1922 at the Conference of Genoa suggested that central banks, and again, this is your world central bankers gathering in Genoa in 1922, they suggested, we just don't need physical gold.
Right. We've got dollars.
Granted, it's useful. Granted, it should be in the mix, but it certainly is more convenient. It's more convenient to settle trade in U.S. dollars and pounds sterling.
Right.
And it was pounds sterling primarily, U.S. dollars secondarily, there at the Conference of Genoa, along with gold. The real significance, Kevin, was that they were using a monetary unit that was more, quote-unquote, convenient to settle foreign trade. And they just didn't want to deal with physical metals and what that required, the labor and the risk involved in transport, et cetera.
How many times have you heard a little voice in the background going, you can trust us. We'll do this right.
And the banking community has always appreciated the opportunity to shuffle a little bit more paper. And that is what happened at the Conference of Genoa, and that's what happened in warp speed as you went through 1933, 1944, 1971, and up to our modern monetary system.
Well, let's move to 1933, because actually this 1922 agreement in Genoa obviously didn't work because they printed too much money, and the redeemability of dollars for gold, ultimately, the dollar had to be devalued, didn't it?
And it was. In 1933, it was devalued by 65%. Prior to the devaluation, you saw $20 gold pieces trading for $30 in France. Mm. So essentially, the market mechanism, again, this is the brilliance of the market. This is people thousands of miles away, Kevin, saying, you know what, something's not right in the United States. And
we'll go ahead and take our gold.
Exactly. Yeah. That $20 gold piece, in paper currency terms, is not worth $20. It's worth $30. So the market had already anticipated in 1931 and 32 a devaluation. And that, I think, is very, very telling. In response, Kevin, to the pressures from the Federal Reserve Bank, in an effort to liquefy the system, Roosevelt restricted the domestic gold trade and required U.S. citizens to hand in their gold. So you can look at the Trading with the Enemy Act if you want to look at what happened in 33, but essentially, the government was still able to settle foreign trade in gold terms,
sure,
but U.S. citizens could not, from 1933 until 1971, own the physical metals.
You know, it may be a misnomer to call that the gold confiscation. Yes, it was a gold confiscation in the United States.
I look at it as a devaluation.
It's more of a devaluation, is it not?
It was. And the reason I say it's a devaluation, and one of the reasons why I'm not particularly concerned about a confiscation, certainly not at 1,500 an ounce, maybe at 25,000 an ounce, it's a different kettle of fish. But at 1,500 an ounce, it's really not an issue, Kevin. Confiscation was not an issue here. Only 10% of the outstanding gold stock was handed in. The rest of your red-blooded Americans said to government, go pound sand. Our gold is our gold. What you want to do in terms of a monetary devaluation will not affect us. We see what you're doing. 90% of the population were not patsies. 90% of the population held on to their gold. And in all fairness, I don't know what percentage of the population was involved. I just know that 90% of the gold was not handed in.
Well, you
only
know,
10%.
With that being said, though, you know, at some point, we don't know what price level that'll be. If a currency actually has to be devalued against something, that something will probably be gold. And so restrictions in the future may come with actual bullion gold.
I mean, Kevin, if you want to count up the amount of gold that even the U.S. has as the largest holder of gold in the world today, it's a pittance compared with even the amount of debt that, say, Greece has. You could liquidate every ounce of gold at today's prices, every ounce of gold held in Fort Knox. Ours is the largest stock of gold in the world, 8,000 tons, and we could just about pay off the Greek debt. Okay, that's how small the gold market is compared to the paper asset world as it has exploded over the last 50 to 75 years.
It's unbelievable, unless they made it illegal and then revalued it at whatever they needed to make it payable. You know, $10,000 an ounce, $50,000 an ounce.
I don't mean to sound seditious, and it wouldn't be because that rule doesn't exist today, but I have confidence in the mind of the average American to, at that point, say, as they did in 1933, to the tune of 90% of the gold outstanding, go pound sand.
Well, you know, the fact that they did leave the dollar backed by gold, at least internationally, led to the power of the Bretton Woods Conference.
You're right. Moving forward to what happened in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, Bretton Woods Conference brought all of your currencies into relationship with the dollar. And that's what we were talking about earlier, Kevin, is the fool's gold standard.
Right.
You know, the reason I mentioned the book, published in 1967, this dialogue between academics when we started our conversation today, Kevin, is that it was in 1968 that U.S. authorities 70s, things were deteriorating.
Right.
In the early 60s, the French, it was not lost on the French. I mean, keep in mind how brilliant they have been through time in looking at monetary dysfunctionality. Okay. And it's no wonder that it's Sarkozy who's proposing how to sort of patch together the current situation, the equivalent of today's Brady bonds, the plan that is to bail out the Greek debt issue in its present incarnation today. Kevin, they've always been sensitive to being number one, if not number two, in the world monetary scene. Even if they never are, they still want to be. And that has them keenly insightful as to what's wrong with the situation so that they can insert themselves into a position of prominence as things begin to play to their favor. That would be sort of the theoretical framework that they're operating on the basis of. 1968 rolls around, the U.S. authorities were reminding their trade partners that quote-unquote friends of America should take greenbacks, will take greenbacks, and if you want gold instead of greenbacks, it will be on a permission-granted basis. You submit a request and we'll let you know when it's accepted, which was very different than what had been agreed to in 1944, which was an automatic transference. You want gold? Take gold. You want dollars? Take dollars.
That's why they accepted it in the first place, because the dollar was to be as good as gold.
It was a gold proxy as far as the international markets were concerned. It was fascinating to me, Kevin, on the plane back, reading this dialogue between Triffin and Mundell, between Mundell and Jacques Roof, John Exeter, who's a classic old gold bug. These guys were battling it out.
Well, and he was a New York Federal Reserve president before that.
That's exactly right. That's John Exeter. Kevin, what's fascinating is that all of them recognized in 67 the importance of gold. The question was how important. It was a question of degrees, not a question of utter irrelevance. And that's what I find particularly interesting today. You have somebody like a Robert Zoellick at the World Bank who says gold needs to be a part of our current monetary system.
Right.
And he's laughed at. And these guys don't realize that as recently as 1967, everyone and their brother said, well, of course it's important, because guess what? You'll lose public confidence. What they didn't realize is that financiers and bankers could step in and through great Houdiniism, great smoke and mirrors, create a perception of stability in the paper currency markets
for 40 years.
That would create the sense and the impression and the perception that gold is irrelevant to any monetary system. That's why Robert Zoellick is laughed off the stage today.
Well, David, speaking of 40 years, okay, in 1971, we're coming up to the 40-year anniversary of Nixon closing the gold window completely, which these guys that you're talking about, Jacques Roof especially, in 1967 and 68 saying, look, you better cash your dollars in for gold. Do it as quickly as you can, because the United States will not honor this forever.
Kevin, in our most recent DVD, we just finished it, and it's going to be available here in the next 2 weeks for either a download on the internet, or if you want a physical copy, feel free to request a physical copy. We'll be making tens of thousands of those available. But if you want to just view it immediately online, that will be available here in the next week or two. The reason I mention it is because we have the footage of Nixon talking about the suspension of convertibility, and he uses the same word that Ben Bernanke has become very comfortable with, the word temporary.
We are temporarily suspending
convertibility in the interest of the stability of the world monetary system. It's amazing. It's amazing to see him say it with all sincerity, and to realize that sincerity is worth what you pay for it. Not more than about a cup of coffee.
Okay, 1971, something significant happened, because for the first time ever in the history of the world, the entire world was just based on paper.
Well, that's right, Kevin. And to be in a completely fiat system backed by nothing, this is where you have just a banker's guarantee or promise to pay. And what that means is there is no limitation to the quantity of money and credit that can be created.
Right.
We saw an inflation bias, an inflation crisis in the 1970s, and arguably we see that in the pipeline for today, whether that's this year, next year, over the next 3 to 5 years. The dollar has maintained its status as the world's reserve currency following 1922, following 1933, following 1944, following the end of convertibility to gold in 1971.
Right.
And that's the question, is can the dollar remain the world's reserve currency today? We have Wen Jiabao traveling throughout Europe today, promising support, not being specific in what he will support, but the Chinese see the significance of the dollar taking at least a step down, not necessarily a step towards irrelevance, not necessarily a step towards oblivion. I don't think anyone is assuming that the dollar is going away completely, but the fact that the Chinese are the new champions of the euro, a monetary unit which is fraught with internal problems, we don't need to explore that any more than we have in recent weeks. But Kevin, the fact that they are champions of this means that they are unwilling to allow the world to go back to a unipolar monetary system centered on the U.S. dollar.
Well, David, within the last month, we interviewed the author of Exorbitant Privilege. And one of the things that he was saying was that really, we're probably going to lose that exorbitant privilege. And, you know, the reserve currency status that has been so sweet to America, that's just really encouraged consumption as a form of GDP. That lifestyle has to change.
And Kevin, the reason we had Eichen Green on the program is not because we're necessarily a champion of every one of his ideas or even any of his ideas. But when he wrote an article in Foreign Affairs more than a year ago, and it was an introduction essentially to his book, Exorbitant Privilege, I knew at the time that the Council on Foreign Relations and the mucky-mucks in Washington and globally would be looking at this and saying, you know, I think he's got a point. It's no wonder, Kevin, today you brought this article to my attention. Dollar seen as losing global currency reserve status. This is a sampling of opinions by UBS, the Swiss bank, of your global central bankers who control roughly $8 trillion worth of assets. Some of those are dollar deposits. Some of them are non-dollar deposits.
That's $8,000 billion or $8 million dollars. So that's a huge chunk.
They surveyed 80 central bank reserve managers, sovereign wealth funds, and multilateral institutions. And the conclusion was, nope. The dollar can't keep its status as the world's reserve currency. How long does that take? Is that a crisis event? Is that something that evolves over a period of time? I can tell you that there is money on the table and a guarantee that the Chinese will not allow this to occur. They will not allow an implosion in Europe to occur. It seems inevitable. And this is sort of point and counterpoint to our conversation with Bill King in the last week, where, yes, this is the death of Western socialism, the collapse of Western socialism. You see that in Europe today. Better than socialism is communism in a command economy that says, yeah, but we don't want to go back to being at the end of a U.S. whip. We don't want to be completely dependent on a consumer base in the United States. We realize we need to expand our market share and, in fact, have expanded our market share. Europe is one of our largest trade partners next to the United States, and we're not about to see that impaired. We want to see stability in the Eurozone. We want to see stability in the euro, and we're willing to put money on it. That's their guarantee.
You know what's amazing, Dave? They are swinging a big, big bat. They have a huge amount of money, as we know, in reserves. You go back to the 1950s, late 40s, 50s, 60s, and the fear was that a communist country, in this case it was Russia, would swing a big bat internationally. What's interesting is we have sold basically our soul away by going off of the gold standard, printing all this money, creating this incredible debt, not just here in the United States, but in Europe. And now you've got a country, a communist country, a command-controlled country, that's coming in, and actually, you know, the borrower truly is the servant to the lender.
Kevin, it's fascinating. The question I started the interview with last week with Bill King was, what is being birthed in Europe? And he said, without skipping a beat, a gold standard.
Yeah. It was like you caught him off guard. He didn't expect that question, so it just came right out of his instinct.
What is he talking about? I don't know. We didn't explore it fully in the conversation last week. But, Kevin, I think we're moving towards a period of monetary crisis, not just with the dollar, but a global monetary crisis, in which the only means of bringing stability into the system is to go back to what was regarded as axiomatic as recently as 1967, 1968, 1970, leading into 71 and the suspension of convertibility. What was axiomatic prior to 1922, prior to 1914, what was considered to be absolutely true by Jefferson, not necessarily by Hamilton, that you can never trust a central banker with your money.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.